I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Lawsuits filed against the prestigious Johns Hopkins Health System have made headlines. Today, a look at three cases. A suit filed by the Orioles minor league outfielder Nolan Reimold against Hopkins Hospital for negligent medical care. A $1 billion suit alleging Hopkins' involvement in disturbing medical experiments on human subjects in the 1940s and 50s. And the $190 million settlement between Hopkins Medicine and the patients of Dr. Nikita Levy, the gynecologist who secretly photographed hundreds of women during exams. We'll hear from attorneys, from Danny Jacobs, who covers courts for the Daily Record, and we'll hear what Hopkins has to say about each case. Legal challenges to one of the world's top medical systems on Midday after the news from NPR. Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here on WYPR Baltimore, WYPF Frederick in Hagerstown, WYPO over on the Eastern Shore in Ocean City, and streaming live online through our website, WYPR.org. We thank you again for making Midday part of your day. It's Earth Day. In the second hour of our show today, we're going to be talking about trash in Baltimore. What do you do about trash in Baltimore? A lot of trash ends up in the Inner Harbor this week. Enough trash to fill 6.5 dumpsters, we're told, came into the Inner Harbor on Monday after that big rain on the rains on Sunday and into Monday. So anyway, what do you do about it? There's some people who have some ideas, and they have some activities and actions taking place this weekend, today and through the weekend, that we'll tell you about in the second hour of our show today. Should be an interesting conversation. What do you do about trash? How do you get people to stop dumping their trash on the sidewalks and in the back alleyways of the city? In this hour of the show, though, we're going to be talking about lawsuits filed against Johns Hopkins Medicine, one of the world's most prestigious hospital and medical research centers. These lawsuits have made headlines recently. Today, a look at three cases, a suit by the Orioles minor league outfielder Nolan Reimold against Hopkins Hospital for negligent medical care, the $190 million settlement with the patients of Dr. Nikita Levy, the Hopkins gynecologist who secretly photographed women during exams, a case that became contentious and controversial because the plaintiff's attorneys were seeking $66 million in legal fees. That sum was cut in half to around $32 million by a Baltimore Circuit Court judge earlier this month, but nonetheless strikes some as exorbitant. We'll talk about that. We'll also discuss a recently filed $1 billion suit that alleges Hopkins' involvement in a disturbing syphilis study conducted in Guatemala in the 1940s. That case involved hundreds of plaintiffs and stems from government research into sexually transmitted diseases. And we'll finish the hour with some perspective on all this from Gregory Dolan. He's an associate professor of law and co-director of the Center for Medicine and Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. So he'll be joining us as well. We'll hear from attorneys in these cases, and I have statements to read from Johns Hopkins on each one of them. We start our conversation with the most recent case, the Nolan Reimold case, filed by Hassan Murphy of the law firm Murphy, Falcon & Murphy. Hassan Murphy representing Nolan Reimold in this case. Nice to have you on the show, Hassan.
Thanks, Dan.
Nolan Reimold had a lot of fans in Baltimore. We're hoping for the best from him, and he had a couple of seasons where he started off really great at the plate, an outfielder. Injuries have been his problem off and on for the last few years. He was with the Orioles. He went to the Blue Jays, came back to the Orioles. Now he's in the minor league. So please tell us about the nature of your suit. What does your suit claimed happened at Hopkins or
well,
didn't happen?
First of all, thanks for having me, Dan.
Yeah.
And I wanted to first tell you that we all hope for big things from Nolan still. But in 2012, Nolan was finally fulfilling his vast potential. He was leading the American League and the Orioles in most major offensive categories, batting average, home runs, RBIs, runs scored. And he jumped into the stands trying to save a home run. He ended up with herniated discs in his neck and needed surgery. Surgery was performed at Johns Hopkins by Dr. Gokaslin. And Dr. Gokaslin cleared Nolan to play much too soon. when you conduct that kind of surgery, the vertebrae need to fuse before you can resume physical activity, especially as a professional athlete. Dr. Gokaslan misread the x-rays, cleared Nolan to play. The x-rays are clear that the vertebrae were not fused. There was no complete fusion. And so Nolan set out to get himself ready for the season, really every day further injuring himself and causing his neck to deteriorate. He continued to try to play because that's the kind of guy that he is, and he just simply, it was too much. He couldn't play through the pain. He went and got another opinion, and the doctor discovered that he needed, that there was no fusion, and he needed to have the same surgery again. And, you know,
and that was a year later.
That was a year, well, yes, it was a year later that he had the second surgery. And, you know, this is a, baseball is a game of precision, right? It is a game that requires very succinct and specialized skill. And with that kind of surgery, to have it twice has a significant impact on your ability to perform.
And these days, Nolan Reimold is in the minor leagues, back with the Orioles.
He's back with the O's. The O's, you know, the O's have been so good to him. They really have. I give them a lot of credit because they've stuck with him through these problems and really want the best for Nolan.
He had a pretty good spring, no?
He had
this
a great
year?
Spring. He
really did. So there's a chance that he will play on the Orioles this year.
We're hoping. We are hoping that he will be able, he's on the road to recovery, and he'll be able to put it back together again.
I noticed there's no monetary amount or damages attached to this suit. Why is that?
Well, it depends, Dan, whether or not he recovers. So if Nolan has recovered, which we all hope that he has, then hopefully he'll begin back on his path of success, and he'll begin to earn. He'll begin to get contracts commensurate with his ability, and so his damages will be limited to the 2 years that he lost, and the part of the arc of his earning capacity that he lost throughout his career. If it happens to be that this injury really doesn't allow him to get going again, then the damages will be bigger. And so we've got to kind of let this play out, and I think it'll be clear by the time we get to trial sometime next year.
He batted .340 this spring, for the record, and is currently in Norfolk with a AAA team.
Yes.
Yeah. One other thing I wanted to ask you about, how these suits are filed these days, the Healthcare Alternative Dispute Resolution Office.
Yes.
So that's not part of circuit court? What is that? Actually?
No, the Maryland General Assembly, the legislature, mandated that medical malpractice cases get filed first in that department, really as a means of trying to resolve them before they go to trial. The practical effect is that people file there and then they immediately waive out, and very few cases get resolved as the statute hopes. So the case was filed there. We've already filed a motion to move out, to waive into circuit court so that we can get a scheduling order, we can get a trial date, and we can get moving.
Johns Hopkins Hospital provided a statement on this for us. We don't have any guests from Hopkins on the show today, but we have statements from the institution. We are limited in what we can say due to privacy and the fact that the case is currently being litigated. We believe that Johns Hopkins met the standards of care for this surgery of Nolan Reimold.
Standard fare for Johns Hopkins.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much, Hassan Murphy, for being here representing Nolan Reimold. And we hope to see Nolan Reimold up with the big team this year.
So do I. Again. And thanks so much for having me.
All right. Thank you very much. We turn now to Danny Jacobs, reporter for the Daily Record, to talk about another case, the Nikita Levy lawsuit. And although it's been settled for a while, we still wanted to talk about it because a dispute kind of erupted at the end of this whole thing. Danny Jacobs, nice to have you on the show again.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
All right, let's first of all, the facts of the Nikita Levy case and the settlement for our listeners.
Sure. He worked at Hopkins. He was a gynecologist there. Worked there from 88 until 2013 when the hospital ended his employment after they were alerted to possible misconduct by him. Police ended up finding 10 file servers worth of photos and videos among his possessions. These were pictures of his patients. And the plaintiff's lawyers said all the images will be destroyed as part of the case. But after he was terminated, he committed suicide less than 2 weeks later, and he was fired. And then the lawsuit started coming in. 2,500 patients initially filed suit.
How many? 2,500?
2,500 initially. And now in the settlement, There's about 8,000 plus plaintiffs that are part of the class action.
These are women who they determined he had taken photographs of during pelvic exams?
Yes. The whether or not he took pictures of everyone is still kind of in dispute, which was part of the litigation, would have been part of the trial had it gone that far.
Okay. And the final settlement, July, this goes back to last summer, right?
Yeah.
I think the final order on the settlement was later in the year, but it was $190
million. Yes, $190 million for all the plaintiffs.
It covered 8,000 plaintiffs by the end?
Yep, a little between 8,000 and 9,000.
Wow. And yeah. Okay, so we thought this case was finished, I guess. It wasn't finished for the victims, I guess, who are still dealing with the trauma of the idea of this whole thing happening to them. But anyway, the lawyers stood to collect some $66 million in fees out of this settlement. And, you know, whenever you mention a number like that, of course, $190 million sounds like a lot. When you're talking about 8,000 plaintiffs, maybe it doesn't sound like all that much considering the offense. But $66 million for lawyers. So first of all, how did they – there must have been something in the contract with the plaintiffs that made them eligible for that.
Sure.
Right?
A lot of plaintiffs' lawyers have in their contract with their clients that they're going to collect they will cover a certain amount of the fee that their clients receive. And I think in this case, the number on the sheet was somewhere between 30% and 40%. So that was known ahead of time. And after the settlement was announced, there was always going to be a sort of attorney's fees phase where people can challenge the amount that's being awarded. The plaintiff's lawyers asked for 35%, which would be about $66 million of the $190 million. There was a hearing in the fall over the fees. There were only a couple objections to the fees. Some people said they didn't quite earn the money. Some people said that they only represented about 4,000 of the 8,000 patients. So how could they collect money for their clients that weren't theirs? The lawyers strenuously objected to those arguments that they did, you know, the best work they could do to get this verdict.
And how many lawyers are you talking about, Danny?
There are about eight legal teams, eight firms involved, mostly Baltimore area firms that were part of what's called the class council that sort of oversaw the negotiations with Hopkins over 20 months that they were with the case.
Okay, but so a judge said, you know, I find this interesting that plaintiffs agree to a certain amount, but then they get to challenge it later, right? That's what you just said.
Yeah, essentially that's how it works. And because of the size of the settlement, there was a chance for people to object to how much they were getting.
And some did.
Some did. Okay. But the lawyers argued, and the judge agreed when he ruled last week, a couple weeks ago, was that based on the way the case was structured, Hopkins had what's called a wasting insurance policy, meaning any money that they used toward their legal fees wouldn't go toward the plaintiffs. It was all from one pot. So there's no separate legal fees for them in this case. So it was in the best interest of the plaintiffs to settle as quickly as they could in order to recover more money. So they had that factor going for them. Also, the judge mentioned in his opinion that the nature of the case, they didn't want to have these plaintiffs come into court and testify about, you know, potentially emotionally damaging things.
Yes.
And the judge also said, and the plaintiff's lawyers, when I talked to him, agreed that there was a chance Hopkins could win on some of these claims because one of the questions was how could the plaintiffs identify themselves in the photos? Maybe some of them didn't get photos taken of them. They wouldn't know that. So Hopkins could have, you know, argued this in court, run the clock out, and sort of had no money left over for the plaintiffs, even if they won. So all things considered, the judge said that these plaintiffs did the best they could do under, you know, they called it exceptional work in the amount of time they had to settle the case.
And so the final amount was, I said, actually less than half than the original amount.
Yeah, right? It was about 17%, $32 million of what they were requesting. He noted that the fees in these kind of cases, settlements over $100 million were between 4% and 18%. And the judge also said the sheer number of plaintiffs, I want to give more money to the plaintiffs rather than the lawyers, was what it kind of came down
to. Well, that's interesting. Glad you mentioned that more commonly it's between 4% and 18%.
That's what the judge found. Doing some research.
Which is very different from, as you say, going through a whole trial and everything.
Yes. Yeah. The way this case was set up, everyone had to go through this class. It was a mandatory class action, so everyone had to go in with this lawsuit. There was no way for someone to file on their own against Hopkins. So the nature of the case made the settlement so large and made the lawyer's payments so large.
Right. Danny, thank you for filling us in.
Thanks, Dan.
Danny Jacobs from The Daily Record. You're listening to The Midday Show. We have to take a quick break here. When we come back, we'll hear about a lawsuit that alleges that Hopkins was involved in government experiments in the 1940s that deliberately infected research subjects with sexually transmitted diseases such as syphilis and gonorrhea, experiments that were conducted in Guatemala. Please stay with us for that. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here, taking a look at lawsuits filed against the prestigious Johns Hopkins Medical System. Particularly interesting one here that we're going to talk about in this segment of the show. Our next guest is one of the lead attorneys in a $1 billion lawsuit filed recently against Johns Hopkins. The suit alleges that Hopkins was involved in government experiments in the 1940s that infected research subjects with sexually transmitted diseases, including syphilis and gonorrhea. These experiments were conducted in Guatemala. Paul Beckman is with us, a personal injury attorney with the downtown law firm Salisbury, Clements, Beckman, Martyr, and Adkins. He's the lead attorney in this case. Paul Beckman, nice to have you on the show.
Great to be here, Dan.
I think a lot of our listeners are wondering, you know, a suit from the 1940s, what is this all about? Some people may have heard about this. President Obama actually apologized at some point for the government's role in these experiments. So let's back it up and do a bit of the history here. Please tell us about this research.
Okay, so we really have to go back even before the 40s to talk about what took place in Guatemala in the mid-40s, beginning in about 1947. In the 30s, there was an experiment that many people may have heard about called the Tuskegee Experiment. It involved 600 African-American men who had syphilis. And an experiment was begun to give them what amounted to a placebo. They were not treated for their syphilis. And they were followed over a period, if you can believe this, of 38 years to 1970. And the reason that the experiment went on in Tuskegee was because they wanted to see, in essence, what the pathogenesis was. What was the nature of the disease? How did it develop? How did it, how many problems would develop as a result of having syphilis? None of these people were ever treated. And the reason that you have to look at the Tuskegee experiment is because researchers from Johns Hopkins University and Johns Hopkins Hospital were intimately involved in the design of those experiments. The collection of data, examinations, creation of forms. One of the people involved was an individual by the name of Earl Moore, known at the time and later on as the world's greatest syphilologist involving syphilis and the study of syphilis. So that study continued on from the 30s into the 40s, into the 50s, and thereafter. It was wartime in the 1940s. U.S. was engaged in the Second World War. And there was great concern that our servicemen going overseas would be exposed to sexually transmitted disease, wherever they might be, whether it's Europe, whether it would be in the Far East. And the statistics were, the estimates were, that maybe as many as 350,000 members of the armed forces would be disabled because of sexually transmitted disease. Therefore, there was great attention paid to coming up with a drug that could effectively treat syphilis. This was before the advent of penicillin. So what took place after the study in Tuskegee? There was a study done in 1944 at a prison in Terre Haute, Indiana, where there were quote-unquote volunteers who were imprisoned who were basically exposed to gonorrhea. They ended up shutting down that experiment after 10 months. And who were the people who were involved in that experiment? Dr. Earl Moore from Johns Hopkins University.
So he was still affiliated with Hopkins.
Affiliated with Hopkins, right. Full-time, paid by Hopkins. And at the time, and particularly in the 40s, there were what are called study sections. And there was a syphilis study section. And members of all hospitals, all institutions, if they wanted to progress and become full professors, were encouraged to become involved in study sections. These were independent study sections. These were not arms of the United States government. You worked on a syphilis study section. You were not paid by the government. You were not an employee of the government. And that is because what the government said was, look, we do not have the expertise to determine what experiments should be done. So what we're going to do is you come to us, syphilis study section, and you tell us what should we be doing.
And then we'll fund you?
And we will fund you.
Okay.
And we have the documents that clearly show that.
What happened in Terre Haute, though?
They shut that one down. Shut it down. There was a great concern that this was really not any real informed consent. These were people who were prisoners. And there's really a question about whether or not you can give consent under those circumstances.
And what year is that, Paul?
1945, it was shut down.
Okay. But it went on during the war.
It went on during the war.
Okay. So how do we get to Guatemala?
So, coincidentally, at the same time, the world's leading syphilologist, Earl Moore from Hopkins, writes an article in 1945 called The Chemotherapy of Syphilis. And in the article that he writes that is published, he says, experimental study must simultaneously proceed in man, not just in the laboratory. So where could they go? They had to go to a place where nobody would know what they were doing. And where was that? At the time, a third world country, Guatemala. United States had good relationship with Guatemala, good relationships with the military. And as a matter of fact, we believe that the entree to the whole study was through a Colonel Tejada in the Guatemalan army, whose wife was suffering from mercury poisoning. And how was that going to be taken care of? Well, Johns Hopkins Hospital was contacted, and one of the members of the syphilis study section had come up with a treatment for mercury poisoning. And that drug was shipped down to Guatemala for Colonel Tejada's wife.
And that's how the connection
was
made?
And that's how it started. They started with an experiment which was proposed by the same syphilis study section, chaired by Dr. Moore. There were six members of the study section.
Did the government fund it?
Government funded it.
So the government was okay with this experiment?
They were okay.
Even though it shut down the Terre Haute one?
They were okay. And here's what the original application was in 1947 to fund this project. The Guatemala study dealing with the transmission of syphilis to human volunteers. That was the program. Right there, written out.
Where did they center the experiment in Guatemala?
In Guatemala City.
In a hospital, or where was it done?
They had a lab, and they brought people to the lab. But they also made visits, and we can document this, to orphanages, to schools, to insane asylums, to people who were incarcerated, people who were in the army, the most vulnerable populations of all. And they were never told anything about what they were getting.
No consent?
Nothing. No consent whatsoever. Whereas in Terre Haute, there were written consents that the inmates had to sign. There had to be an informed consent before anything was done. Nothing. Zero.
Were there experiments in the transmission of the disease?
Absolutely. And in fact, we have evidence that shows that shipped from Baltimore, in a lab that was run by an employee of Hopkins, a Dr. Thomas Turner, who had a syphilis lab, which was also funded by the Rockefeller Foundation, syphilitic rabbits were shipped down from Baltimore, from the laboratories in Johns Hopkins, to Guatemala, and used to extract spirochetes, which were used and injected into people in Guatemala. Unheard of, unconscionable, compared to Joseph Mengele.
What was the point of the experiments?
The point of the experiments...
Again, to see symptoms, to see effects?
To see symptoms and effects. And in many cases, people were not treated with penicillin. In some cases, there were, and in some cases, there were not.
How did this become known, Paul? You're talking about something that occurred in the 1940s into the 50s, or for how long did this go?
The lab was opened up in 1947, and it continued through 1949, and then there were follow-up studies into the early 50s.
How did we come to find out about this? Was it a top secret operation?
It was a top secret. Nobody wants to. We have letters that say we don't want any goody-goody organization getting wind of this because it'll shut down the experiment. We have the people who are involved in the project saying things like, I'm so tired of this double talk in telling people that this is going to help them. We have a letter from Earl Moore saying, the experiments are going on in Guatemala, but I'm not at liberty to disclose this information to you.
Okay.
So how did it come about?
Yeah, how did it come about?
So after the program was finished, one of the people who was one of the main investigators, who had also been at Terre Haute, came back to Hopkins and got his master's degree in public health. And he was under the arm of Johns Hopkins and under the arm of Earl Moore. No final report was ever published about the study. It was deep sixed intentionally. So what happened? Well,
Excuse me, I want to ask a question there. So there is some documentation.
Oh, there's
documentation.
It's just
that there's no final report.
There's no final report. Okay. We have documentation. And one of the people who were involved in this, who was actually a Public Health Service employee by the name of John Cutler, who had also been involved in Terre Haute and had actually gone on to become involved in Tuskegee, had kept a diary, and he had kept a list of the people that many of the people who were involved and what they got and what kind of penicillin they got and where they got the penicillin from. So what he did is he donated his memoirs to the University of Pittsburgh. And lo and behold, a researcher, a historian, a professor at Wellesley, a woman by the name of Susan Reverby, had written several books on Tuskegee. And she was doing a follow-up, and she had heard about Cutler, who she knew had been involved in Tuskegee and in Terre Haute. And she went to the archives at Pittsburgh. And lo and behold, everything is there. She brings that to the attention of the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta. They bring it to the attention of the State Department. They're horrified. And in September of 2010, it first made the light of day. And then Secretary of State Clinton and President Obama apologized on behalf of the United States.
I remember when the president apologized and the Secretary of State and wondered, how did it get to that point? That's why I asked you that question.
Right. And what the president did is he said, look, I want a presidential commission. I'm appointing a presidential commission, and I want a report back by September the 30th, 2011. And lo and behold, the commission did its work, and a report was rendered not only by the United States presidential commission, but also by a Guatemalan presidential commission, basically saying this was ethically impossible.
Attorney Paul Beckman is our guest in this hour of midday. We're talking about this suit that's been filed against Johns Hopkins Hospital for its role in these government experiments. And I'll read the Hopkins statement while Paul is here, because we don't have a guest from Hopkins to address this, but we do have a statement from Hopkins on the Guatemala experiments. How many people were involved in this? Is there an estimate?
There are two different numbers, really. The United States Commission talked about approximately 1,300. The Guatemalan government report talks about over 2,000.
And how have you gone about identifying plaintiffs in this? Your case, references 800 or so?
774.
Right? 774.
And they are there are still some victims who are still alive, who were children at the time, who were injected, who had their penises scarified with syphilis. They're still alive. Their spouses, some of the spouses that they ended up marrying and who ended up getting syphilis, are still alive. Their children, because it is transmissible, have syphilis, and even to their grandchildren. So these people represent that kind of category of people.
During the experiments, were people encouraged to have sex with people who weren't infected?
They were never told that they had syphilis. They were never told that they were getting syphilis.
So they were just having sex as normal
as
human
normal
beings?
As normal people would.
Yeah, right. And has Guatemala, the government of Guatemala, cooperated with the identification of victims?
They have, and they, in their report, they have identified the names of people. And then there is something what is called the Cutler list. Cutler was the main investigator down
right.
there. And he had identified people, not fully exhaustive, because it did not include the children who were at the orphanage and in the schools.
A Cutler, unlike Earl Moore, did not work for Hopkins.
He was an employee of the United States Public Health Service, but he is somebody who met with, for example, and it should be mentioned that in the study and where the money was asked of the United States, there's a principal investigator. And the principal investigator turns out to be a physician by the name of Fred Soper, S-O-P-E-R, who was an employee of the Rockefeller Foundation. And Soper, we have documentation, went to Guatemala at least six times and met with Cutler. And how do we know that? We know that because Cutler refers to Soper in his correspondence, and Soper had a diary. And Soper talks about his meeting with Cutler and his discussions in detail about what's happening in Guatemala. So one of the other parties to the case, Dan, is the Rockefeller Foundation. Not only on behalf of Soper, who was the principal investigator, knew exactly what was going on, but also the Surgeon General of the United States at the time was a person by the name of Thomas Perrin, who at the time you could work for the government, but you could also be in private business, mm-hmm. and he was a trustee of the Rockefeller Foundation. And we have documents which say, and Perrin says at the time, you know, with a merry twinkle in his eye, we couldn't do this experiment in the United States.
With a merry twinkle in his eye? Those exact words?
Those are his exact words.
I'm going to read the Johns Hopkins statement, Paul Beckman, in order to give the institution its response. Before I do that, we'll take a quick call here for you. A question from one of our listeners, John in White Marsh. John, welcome to the Midday Show.
Thank you. From a malpractice stance, how do you get around the statute of limitations with this?
The statute of limitations has a provision in it that says that you have the right to bring a claim within a certain period of time after you discover that you, in fact, have a claim. You might not know you had a claim. All this was kept secret. There was clear out-and-out fraud in having these people subjected to the experiment. The law gives an exception for fraud and what we call the discovery rule.
I'm going to read this Hopkins statement now from this month, just issued this month and sent over to us here at Midday. Johns Hopkins expresses profound sympathy for individuals and families impacted by the deplorable 1940s syphilis study conducted by the U.S. government in Guatemala. This was not a Johns Hopkins study. Johns Hopkins did not initiate, pay for, direct, or conduct the study in Guatemala. No nonprofit university or hospital has ever been held liable for a study conducted by the U.S. government. It has been well established by a presidential commission that this unconscionable research was funded and executed by the United States government. The President, Secretary of State, Secretary of Health and Human Services have apologized to the Guatemalan government and to all affected. The plaintiff's essential claim in this case is that prominent Johns Hopkins faculty members' participation on a government committee that reviewed funding applications was tantamount to conducting the research itself, and that therefore Johns Hopkins should be held liable neither assertion is true. A class action lawsuit seeking to hold federal officials responsible for the Guatemala study has been filed and dismissed. U.S. District Court Judge Reggie Walton dismissed that action in 2012 and stated that the pleas of victims for relief are more appropriately directed to the political branches of the federal government. Just one more paragraph. For more than half a century since the time of the Guatemala study, scholars, ethicists, and clinicians have worked with government officials to establish rigorous ethical standards for human research. Johns Hopkins welcomes bioethical inquiry into the U.S. government's Guatemala study and its legacy. This lawsuit, however, is an attempt by plaintiffs' counsel to exploit a historic tragedy for monetary gain. Plaintiffs' legal claims are not supported by the facts. We will vigorously defend the lawsuit. So a couple of things there, Paul Beckman. One is that this has already been tested in a federal court. So where does that leave you? I guess you feel that doesn't stop you from proceeding.
Well, again, you have to consider what the case was. This was a case filed in Washington, D.C., in federal court. It was filed on behalf of, I think, four or five victims. And the claim was under what is called the Federal Tort Claims Act against the United States. It was not filed against Hopkins. It was not filed against Rockefeller. It was not filed against any of the drug companies. And the Federal Tort Claims Act, which holds the government responsible for improper conduct, only applies in the United States. It does not apply to acts outside of the United States. So Judge Walton was correct mm-hmm. in dismissing the case. At no time did
And he
that...
said go to Congress.
Yeah, right.
Go to Congress. Let the Congress pay damages for this.
Right. And as you probably would expect, there is no sympathy to do that, and particularly in today's world where we're dealing with all types of budget issues. There's no sympathy for people in Guatemala who were victims of this tragedy. So that case has no bearing whatsoever on this case at all. With regard to the participation of Hopkins, we have filed a 50-page complaint with details, with backup information that we have that documents the intimate involvement of multiple people at Johns Hopkins Hospital who were intimately involved in this project, knew about the project, aided the project, abetted the project, encouraged the project, kept the project secret.
We're doing more than just reviewing funding applications.
Absolutely. They were the architects of the experiment.
Now, your case was filed in the circuit court in Baltimore.
It was filed in the circuit court, and there is a provision under the law that permits a claim to be transferred to federal court if it is based upon more than 100 plaintiffs and if the claim is more than $5 million, both of which categories were met here. So the case is being transferred to the U.S. District Court. It has been assigned to Judge Marvin Garbus.
Thank you for coming in and explaining this and giving us the background on it as well, Paul Beckman from Salisbury, Clements, Beckman, Martyr, and Adkins in Baltimore. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Dan.
We'll take another break here on Midday as we look at these lawsuits against Johns Hopkins University and speak next with Gregory Dolan, Associate Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. And he's co-director of the school's Center for Medicine and Law, so we'll get his perspective on these cases and others like it after this short break here on Midday. And welcome back to the Midday Show. Dan Roderick's here. We get to spend a few minutes now with Gregory Dolan, as a professor at the University of Baltimore School of Law. And we invited him on the show for his perspective on these cases that we've discussed, this litigation, lawsuits against Johns Hopkins medical system, Johns Hopkins Hospital. Gregory Dolan is co-director of UB Law School's Center for Medicine and the Law. Thank you for joining us on the show today, Greg Dolan.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really a pleasure. And before we start, I do want to sort of let your listeners know that I'm happy to be here, but my views are my own and not attributable to either University of Baltimore or to Johns Hopkins, where I also have an appointment. So, but with that understanding out of the way, I'm happy to sort of to talk to you about things that I know and things that I can explain.
Thank you very much, Greg. And by the way, is there a Hopkins affiliation with the Center for Medicine and the Law?
Yes, it's a sort of a joint partnership agreement where that's why I'm a co-director. We have a co-director from Johns Hopkins as well, so a practicing physician, and that's how we envision the center growing in the future as well.
Okay. I just wonder if you had, first of all, some general comments about the first case we talked about today. I guess that's sort of a standard medical malpractice or negligence case in the Nolan Reimold case. Maybe the Nikita Levy case actually leaves us with that question still about the amount of damages lawyers are allowed to collect or were allowed to collect in this case. For some people, it still seems like, you know, a great deal of money for what amounts to a settlement and not a trial.
Well, at the end of the day, in many ways, there's no difference between a settlement and a trial. A settlement is simply an agreement between the parties where one party recognizes its potential liability or at least potential for imposition of that liability by a jury, even if they may think they've done nothing wrong, but they realize that the risk of going to a jury may be very high. And they're willing sort of to settle the matter to avoid potentially even further liability. So cases settle all the time. There's no particular significant legal difference between a settlement and a jury verdict. And indeed, I think to the extent that, and this is not just medical malpractice, it's just a general position. To the extent that you think that you're going to be found liable, it makes sense to settle because the cost of going to trial, the cost of paying lawyers, the cost of getting witnesses, the cost of potential bad publicity may not be worth your while, especially if you know that there's a good chance that you might lose anyways because you actually do believe that you've done something wrong or you could have done something better.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I'll just leave it there.
Yeah, thank you. You know, in thinking about Johns Hopkins, which is a prestigious institution, is a very busy institution, has, you know, thousands and thousands of employees, has been doing research for decades. And, you know, because of that, I guess it it opens up more opportunity for litigation. The more you do, the more risk you take. And I was wondering, as we approach the show today, how does an institution like Hopkins go about insuring itself against large cases like these?
Of course, you're absolutely right on the first point. The more you do, the more risk you take. And I think all of your listeners probably know that from their personal experience. Maybe they're not doctors, but when they bought car insurance, one of the first things the car insurance company asks, do you use the car for business or for pleasure? Do you drive to work? How many miles and so on? Because they know the more miles you drive, the more likely you are to be in an accident, no matter how good of a driver you are. It's just sort of the nature of doing business. And same thing with hospital or any other institution. So the fact that Hopkins is now facing a bunch of lawsuits, I think it's not necessarily indicative of them being a bad place or a dangerous place. It's just they have lots of doctors, lots of employees, spanning oftentimes decades. And, you know, that's just sort of cost of doing business. Now, how do they insure themselves? Mostly, I believe they're self-insured, meaning so they basically set money aside. And also they buy what's called reinsurance. So they buy insurance from other companies to cover really large losses. They have this sort of self-set up insurance company with a number of other prestigious institutions where they cover their losses when they are sued, when they're found liable, or when they settle.
In the case that we were just discussing before you got on the air with us, stemming from the syphilis gonorrhea study in Guatemala, I wonder if you could talk about that. As some people hear 1940s and don't understand how any litigation, how any lawsuit could have success when it's from so many years ago. But as Paul Beckman explained, this only came to light within the last 5 to 6 years. It's what does it sound like to you, this case? Does it sound like a legitimate claim?
I'm loath to give my opinion as to how this will come out. Paul is a good attorney, and he investigated this matter before filing the case. And I trust his judgment, at least in part, that he's not filing frivolous cases because he is, you know, he's a good attorney. That said, I have some, at least some doubts. I'm not sure that they will not be resolved, but I have some doubts about the success of the argument that this is just, you know, this just came out in the last few years, because at least in Maryland, there's this rule that although he's correct that you can basically stop the clock from running if you didn't know of the injury, in Maryland, the rule is you still are not, generally are not permitted to bring the case more than 5 years after the injury has occurred, even if you didn't know about it. So 3 years from discovery of the injury or 5 years from the date of the injury occurring, whichever is shorter, not longer, whichever is shorter. So maybe there are ways to get around it, and maybe so he can come up with creative arguments. I don't want to sort of pour cold water necessarily on his arguments without even having read them, but I think that would be a bit of a stumbling block for him going forward.
Hey, Greg Dolan, in the time we have remaining with you, I wonder if you just make a general comment for us about the state of litigation and hospitals and the practice of medicine today. During the whole debate and rollout of the Affordable Care Act, we heard calls for tort reform, that the medical malpractice was driving the cost of health care in the United States. Generally speaking, where are you on that these days as you survey that?
I actually just taught a class on that very issue last week. And it really depends on how you look at it. The cost of medical malpractice as such, so the cost of premiums, the cost of payments, the cost of just actually the system itself, is really about, is less than 1% of what we spent on health care. Now, the big argument is that, number one, that less than 1% that we spend on health care, it's still $5, $6 billion. So that's not peanuts. Number two is that the argument that it's not that what we spend on judgments, it's what we spend on doing unnecessary tests and so on. And the problem is that it's very hard to quantify which tests are necessary and which are not necessary. So I think the bottom line is, yes, there's a lot of waste, especially when measured in pure dollar amount. We're talking about $15, $20, maybe $50 billion. On the other hand, I don't think that really drives healthcare costs. It adds to them, but I don't think it drives them. I think what drives them are a number of other issues: how we pay for it, who pays for it, what Americans tend to demand, what we tend to provide, and so on. But I don't think malpractice drives them, although it's not an unimportant component.
Thank you very much. And there also have been reforms at the state level, starting here in Maryland. These things have happened already here. It's been a couple of decades since we've had some caps put in place by the legislature, for instance.
Correct. So in Maryland, there's two types of damages that a person can suffer when he's injured. One is what's called economic damages. That's sort of something that's easy to put dollar value on. So, for example, because you were mistreated, you end up spending 3 more days in the hospital, and that has a price tag on it. And you missed 3 days of work, and that has a price. So you can actually take a calculator, paper, and pencil and figure out how much you would have been paid had you gone to work, how much extra you bill for the hospital. And then there's non-economic damages. Those are called pain and suffering.
Right.
And those are kind of, you know, those, I don't want to say they're arbitrary. They're certainly not. But they're much harder to figure out, well, are you in pain for $100,000 or $50,000 or $10,000? Who knows? So economic damages in Maryland are not capped. So, for example, if you're grievously injured and you need health care for the rest of your life to make up for the doctor's mistake, whatever that's going to cost, you are entitled to recover. But pain and suffering is capped in Maryland, although fairly generously, somewhere around, depending on the case, but somewhere around $1 million.
Yes, I know. And every once in a while, the legislature goes back and sort of messes with that a little bit, resets the amount. Greg Dolan, thank you very much for your perspectives today. I'm glad you could join us.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Yep, Associate Professor of Law at University of Baltimore Law School and co-director of the UB Center for Medicine and the Law joined us here as we wrapped up our hour of coverage of these lawsuits against the Johns Hopkins medical system. Tuesday's lunch on Midday provided by Bagby Pizza Company, located in the historic Bagby Building near Harbor East. Bagby Pizza is open daily from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. with delivery nightly from 5 to 9 p.m.